Hi, this is Gabe Newell, and you're listening to the 7-Day Cooldown.
Friday, April 20th, I'm Jack Einiker, General Manager here at the 7-Day Cooldown. Joining us for our inaugural interview is co-founder and current Managing Director of Valve, Mr. Gabe Newell. Gabe, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm also joined by Mitch Fryman, who's going to have a number of questions relating to upcoming Steam releases, but as our show is created by Redditors, for Reddit, we solicited a number of questions for the interview off of the site. So to start us off, Dull Diehard wants to know, how are you and how is Hawaii?
Oh, Hawaii's great. Every year, I don't know, I think we've probably done it about 10 times now. The whole company packs up, and we used to go to Mexico or we went to the Caribbean once, but it ends up being a huge problem for people who are at Valve on visas. Because, you know, they have to go through all sorts of shenanigans. So now we just pretty much stick to Hawaii. Great thing is all the families get to find out why we've stolen one of their family members for the last year and get a little bit of it back.
Now, I'm going to turn this over to Mitch because I know he has a lot of questions for you regarding Dota 2, CSGO. So, Mitch, why don't you kick it off?
All right. Thank you, Jack. And thanks again for joining us, Gabe. It's a great honor.
Thanks.
I'll start with Dota 2 first, and I'll start with the Redditor as well. Paraphrasing from Redditor Darth Cupcake, will Dota 2 appeal to both noobs and experienced players, or will noobs have a hard time adjusting to the game?
There are a bunch of things that we're trying to do to accommodate a wide range of skill levels, because really good players don't have a lot of fun steamrolling new players and vice versa. So I think that in general, we've done a good job of making the game a lot more accessible while also doing a lot to support people up through the professional players. It should be also... There are more things for advanced players to do in terms of some of the stuff we're doing with items and how they can sort of develop their own following and do broadcasting and things like that. So overall, we're trying to make sure that we address, you know, the concerns of both highly skilled and novice players.
Okay. Do you plan to add more heroes and items beyond what the original Dota included? And if so, will these incorporate community-created heroes and items such as TF2 does?
We're in the process of rolling out the community item support. There are a bunch of people, either from the existing Dota community or for the TF2 community, who are working on interesting items for the characters already. So yes, we fully intend to support that.
Are there more modes planned for Dota 2 beyond all pick, single draft, captain's mode, and random mode?
That's all we're going to do initially. But everybody who's working on it always has 47 different ideas. We just need to get the first stuff out of beta and into people's hands and get all the existing heroes out, and then we can start to go a little bit further afield.
Okay, is Dota 2 a PC exclusive, or will it eventually extend into the Mac and possibly console user base as well?
Mac, yes. Console is a tougher call. We're definitely doing Mac, but we're not sure how well it will map to existing control schemes. So the ones that we're building internally right now are just PC and Mac.
Will Dota 2 follow a similar free-to-play model as TF2, or did you have a different format in mind?
It's how to answer that without being obscure. Yeah, it's going to be a free-to-play. I mean, that's the easiest way to think of it. It'll have some twists, but that's the easiest way to for people to think about it.
If I could follow up on that question, what twist do you anticipate coming up?
The issue that we're struggling with quite a bit is something I've sort of talked about before, which is how do you properly value people's contributions to a community? So we're trying to figure out ways so that people who are more valuable to everybody else, that that's recognized and accommodated. So how do you, you know, we all know people where if they're playing, we want to play. And there are other people where if they're playing, we would like be on the other side of the planet. So it's just a question of coming up with mechanisms so that we recognize and reward people for doing things which are valuable to other groups of people. So, you know, if somebody's doing a really useful guide, if somebody's a really good trainer, those are some of the things that we're trying to accommodate, which I can't really point to an existing free-to-play model and say it's just like that.
That sounds incredibly novel. What impact do you think that will have on the rest of the community, seeing that TF2 has been an amazing model for free-to-play? Do you see that being expanded into other games?
Oh, yeah. The issues that we were wrestling with TF2, we thought as being applicable to lots of different kinds of games. And if you look at what we were doing with Bethesda around Skyrim, you know, that you can see how a bunch of what we learned in TF2 ended up applying in Skyrim. And so when you start thinking about the different games that people play, and you try to think about how people can create value or a service in one game and benefit somebody in a different game, you can start to see how the different games sort of start to be knit together, and how somebody who really likes to play TF2 can still be creating value for somebody who's playing Dota 2 or Skyrim. Or if somebody's a creator in one space, how it can translate into another. You could sort of think about us trying to view, in a sense, think of individual games as sort of instance dungeons of a larger experience. Does that make sense as a concept?
Absolutely. The interesting thing was Ben Kuchera today in an interview, Centerpiece for PA Report, was actually going into seeing Valve and Steam at large as a larger social network. Is that how you view Valve or Steam moving towards that social network interactivity?
Most of the time that people try to ask us questions like that, they usually have really specific things in mind which don't map exactly to what we have in mind. So when somebody says, you know, if somebody from the general business press says, are you going to be more like a social network, what they mean really specifically, are you going to have a website that looks like Facebook? So when I, you know, if I had to talk about a model, it would be more about how gamers can benefit from the collective action of all the other gamers. And, you know, there are a bunch of different ways that can occur, whether from things that look like traditional social networking, notification and sharing, but also in terms of higher value activities, right? So as far as I know, Facebook doesn't have the ability for people to fundamentally modify or edit the underlying Facebook experience, right? So you can't like let Bruce Chenier define your privacy policy or something like that. So we're trying to move people up we're trying to make people as valuable as we can. It really, you know, is more a legacy of sort of John Carmack's way of thinking about things than it is, you know, more of the social networking. It's just that now we sort of have the horsepower and the experience in the gaming community to try to figure out how all these different experiences sort of get knit together in a way that's valuable. I don't really think my friends want to know that Gabe finally won a game while playing as, you know, Tidehunter. On the other hand, if I have a mount inside of Skyrim, it'd be pretty darn cool if I had done something. Let's say I created a mount in Skyrim. It'd be great if I could use that as a Dota 2 courier. So that's sort of a more, the latter is more the direction that we think is valuable and important than the former.
It seems like an amazing rollout. I know Mitch wanted to cover one last question regarding Dota 2. Mitch?
First off, what motivated Valve to create a sequel to Dota?
So we talk about our decision-making process and how... I mean, this is kind of interesting, so I'll dwell on it for a second. We don't really have a management structure in the way that most people understand management structures. And one of the things it takes new people a little while to learn is that the most important decision they make is what they work on, and nobody's really going to tell them what the most valuable thing is for them to do. So right now I'm hanging out with a group of people who are working on Linux. You know, and so I just lift up my desk on its wheels and move it into the elevator and take it down, and that's what I'm working on right now. With Dota, there were a group of people who, on their own time, were having a bunch of fun playing Dota. It was actually pretty comical to listen to their stories of their first. They actually tried to go and compete in a tournament. And they got crushed so hard that the other teams were actually trying to coach them on how to play as the competition is going on. Like, it was so bad that they couldn't even, like, look each other in the eye or play Dota again for about 3 months. So after they thought about it a while, they decided that the best thing to do was to get to know Ice Frog better, and maybe he would help them. And then they found out that he didn't really have any... He had this really clear set of ideas of things he wanted to do to make Dota better, but he didn't have a clear way to get there within the framework that he was working in. And they were like, well, this would be a way to finally avenge our incredibly humiliating loss at the tournament. We should go ahead and convince Ice Frog to come to Valve and build the sequel. And that was, you know, Robin and Adrian Finall and Eric Johnson. Adrian got... sort of the first, you know, top-down, you know, tracking your unit perspective game fragment up and running over a weekend, and sort of use that to con more people into working on the project. And it just, you know, the more people who wanted to work on it, the more progress they made, the more people were interested. And that's really how we make a lot of our decisions, is people deciding that this is a really good way to spend their time. When it sort of reached a critical point where a bunch of people started to work on it, we all sat down and sort of said, is this a really bad idea? And decided that it actually seemed like a fine thing to go do. So, you know, that was the closest, you know, that was sort of the point in time where we had the most scrutiny at it. But given the people who were actually starting it, you know, and were most excited about working on it at the beginning, it tended to give the other people at Valve a lot of confidence that rather than being a bizarre and really bad idea, that this was probably going to turn out to be pretty good. But that really was the genesis of us bringing Ice Frog here and working on Dota 2.
All right, and I just have one more Dota question. Who is your personal favorite hero, and who is your least favorite hero to play, and why?
Wow. I play random now a lot, which obviously isn't a hero, and that's kind of a game developer answer. It forces me to try everything out. If I had to pick one, I sort of have a soft spot for Sand King, because the first couple of times I won matches, I was playing as Sand King, and... first time I figured out how to do shift queuing was with Sand King. Do it reliably in a real match. My least favorite? It's not really the hero's fault. It's sort of my fault. I play Morphling really badly. I get behind really fast with Morphling and then get frustrated and stupid. So Morphling brings out the worst in me. So it's probably my least favorite hero. The flaw is with me, not with Morphling on that one.
Yeah.
As is pointed out to me somewhat relentlessly by the other Dota 2 players.
I haven't encountered very many great morphlings, but when you do, they're very scary to go up against. It's true. I can't play it myself either. What does CSGO have to offer to players of 1.6 and Counter-Strike Source that those games can't match themselves?
Well, it's sort of like the difference between where we were at with TFC and TF2. We've had, a lot of water has gone under the bridge. So it's just a lot of refinement, a lot of content. There's the feel issues. There tend to be a lot of subtle, people have been playing the various incarnations of Counter-Strike for a long time, have super strong opinions about some of the subtleties of aiming and other kinds of things. And, our sense is we've done a pretty good job of taking the best of both 1.6 and Source and combining those in CSGO. And unless the beta testers are blowing smoke up our ass, I think we've done that. Hopefully it's going to help consolidate the two communities, that everybody will look at it and say, okay, this is the version of Counter-Strike I've been waiting for. We do think, though, that that's what it gives them is, an up-to-date, current, rich content version of the game that they've been playing.
All right. And then along the same lines, kind of, how will CSGO cater to the competitive and casual communities?
It's going to have if you look at TF2 and you think of that as a set of components, of features, of functionality, that's a lot of the kinds of pieces that you're going to be seeing on CSGO. I'm trying to think specifically of sort of pro features. I'm gonna cheat and just defer that to Ido. So if you want to, I'll make a note and have him send you a list of things. You can just append it.
That'd be great. Thank you.
All right. For CSGO, do you plan on incorporating classic maps from 1.6 yep. that were excluded from Source, such as 747?
I don't know
Back
about
Alley?
747, but we're going to bring those forward.
And then what is your favorite gun in CSGO?
I'm just an M4 kind of guy, so that hasn't really changed.
I actually love the P90 now in CSGO. But, okay, from Redditors Toyoka and Cheesy Rat, when can we expect the SDK to be released for CSGO?
The plan right now is within 3 months after we release. The guy who will be releasing it is Mike Durand.
Okay, and we'll move along to some somewhat Half-Life series questions. Do you plan on bringing back Adrian Shepard into the storyline?
We've talked about it. We have nothing concrete, but we know a lot of people are fans of his, and we certainly haven't snuffed him or anything.
I personally am a big fan of Adrian as well, so hopefully I'm hoping he comes back. But was it difficult having your character Eli, one that's been present throughout the storyline, get killed off?
Well, it's one of those decisions you have to make about characters. If nobody ever dies, then there's no risk and there's no tension. And if it's pretty soon you turn into Gilligan's Island, where nothing can possibly change because everybody has these expectations. It was actually, there's a pretty heated argument internally over whether or not to kill off Eli. It's kind of a drag. If you build these characters, you have kind of a different relationship to somebody to them than somebody who's playing with them in a game. But there's, in both cases, there's you have complicated feelings about killing the characters off. But one of the things that we knew is that without having those options, right? I mean, Shakespeare killed off lots of his characters, as Joss Whedon recently pointed out. And it's just a function of trying to create the best story. It's sort of an obvious choice you have to make because it's kind of a binary thing. Well, I mean, unless you introduce space ghosts or something. But there are lots of choices that you have to make along the way and you have to come up with you have to be comfortable taking risks with the story side. Otherwise, you know, you may be making a group of people really happy with a set of very safe decisions, but that group of people will get smaller and will get bored over time. So you have to actually tell stories that resonate and have meaning. And part of that is feeling like everything isn't predictable. You know, we didn't kill him off because it was going to be surprising. I mean, there were a bunch of other reasons that happened in terms of how the story is moving. But there are risks to becoming sort of lazy about how the story moves forward.
I mean, were you guys debating on who to kill off, kind of? Or, I mean, was it just Eli and then that was the debate?
Yeah, we didn't say, oh, we have to kill somebody off. It was more about this makes sense in terms of... mainly it's about Alex more than anything else, and also about Alex's relationship with you, the player. That's really what was driving that decision.
All right. And then my final question, and the question in the back of all your fans' minds, and everyone has been waiting to ask you for a long time. When can we expect the release of Ricochet 2?
In terms of Ricochet 2, we always have this problem that when we talk about things too far in advance, we end up changing our minds as we're going through and developing stuff. So as we're thinking through the giant story arc, which is Ricochet 2, you might get to a point where you're saying something is surprising us in a positive way and something is surprising us in a negative way. And... you know, we'd like to be super transparent about the future of Ricochet 2. Problem is, we think that the twists and turns that we're going through would probably drive people more crazy than just being silent about it until we can be very crisp about what's happening next.
I actually have a quick follow-up on Ricochet 2 and whether or not you were talking a little bit about the horizontal structure at Steam and Valve, the fact that people move from project to project with Ricochet 2. Have you had people moving off that project and that's kind of slowed down the development cycle? Or
No. Everybody who is working on Ricochet 2 continues to work on Ricochet 2.
Ricochet is a very fun LAN game. It's very fun, so I'm looking forward to Ricochet 2's imminent release.
Okay.
That's all the questions for me, so I'll go ahead and send it back to Jack.
Thanks, Mitch. I really appreciate that. Has there been any progress being made to Origin-exclusive games coming back to Steam? And can you talk a little bit about the business relationship with EA at the moment?
So, I mean, we'd love to have their games on Steam. We think their customers would be happy if their games were on Steam. You know, we tell them that on a regular basis. You know, I think that EA wants to take their shot at building their own alternative to Steam. You know, and if they're successful at that and their customers like that, then that's great. We'd be happy to have all their games on Steam, and we'd like them to recognize that whatever they're trying to do to create value for their customers is not, it's not a zero-sum game, right? That as we learn about this stuff, we're all going to be making things better for other gamers, right? You know, Tim Sweeney doesn't look at Steam and say, you know, fuck, we shouldn't support that because that'll hurt long-term sales of the Unreal Engine. He's like, ah, that's pretty cool and that's pretty useful. So, you know, and hopefully EA gets their head to the same place.
I mean, you always supply a pretty candid answers to these questions, and I know you play a lot of platforms on a lot of different services. Have you tried out Origin, and what are your thoughts on the product?
I have used Origin. It seems, I mean, they have a lot of work to do for to get to where they want to be and where I as a customer would want them to be. So
Is there anything that Origin is doing right now that you think it's doing well?
Well, I mean, I don't really want to dodge the question. No, I don't really think they're doing anything super well yet. They have a bunch of smart people working on it, but I think they're still playing catch up to a lot of people who've been working in this space for a while. So, you know, no, I don't think that that they've caught, you know, I think they're recognizing what the challenges are with building and scaling out this kind of system. That isn't to say that they won't build stuff in the future that isn't super valuable to either software developers or to gamers, but they haven't done that yet.
In the same vein, Valve has not only become a huge distributor of games, but also a producer in content. What directions do you think in the industry have taken that you're most happy about?
Fundamentally, I think that our industry is going to live or die based on its ability to come up with new ways to make customers happy, right? I mean, we're going to, you know, we, in spite of how, you know, people like to talk about Origin versus Steam or, you know, Halo or Battlefield versus Call of Duty, I think that we're so far from being in a zero-sum game. I mean, the real question is, you know, are people going to spend their time playing games, or are they going to go, you know, browse the internet, or are they going to go to a movie, or are they going to go to a softball game? You know, we're really still very much at the phase where there are so many more people who aren't playing games than there are people who you might get to switch from one game to the other. The reality is anybody who plays a game and has a great time is way more likely to buy another game. So our biggest issue really is, you know, shitty games are like much worse for us as an industry overall. It's not like you go, oh, goody, that customer has dollars in their pocket, they'll spend them on my game. It's more like they just aren't going to buy games in general, and they'll go do something else with their time. So the thing that I think is best is that it used to be that game developers, the people who are actually building the games, were very, very far away from their customers. And nowadays, you can have a game developer talking to a customer while they're playing the game, fixing a problem and getting the fix or the improvement or the new piece of content out to those customers, and, you know, do that in a matter of hours, if not minutes. And I think the closer that the people who are actually building the product to the people who are consuming it, and the more the line blurs between the creators and consumers of that, I think that gives us this gigantic advantage over any other entertainment field. You know, I'll do, you know, a podcast with you guys, and it's so much easier to do that and for me to, you know, make notes about confirming which of the CS1.6 maps are going to be in CSGO and when the SDK is going to come out, you know, than it is for Steven Spielberg to make some change to Warhorse as a result of the reactions or the communications he's having with fans. He's pretty much screwed. By the time it even gets to a point where people can react to what he's doing, it's too late. You know, he's done everything he.
But is there an
everything he can?
Is it,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say just everything that he could possibly do to make customers happy is pretty much he's lost that opportunity by the time it, you know, it's anywhere close to being something that you know you could get real reactions to. And so I think that's a huge advantage. You know, it goes back to the, you know, the plan file, you know, the finger file wars, you know, back in the mid 90s. You know, it was actually awesome to see people responding and reacting in a very public way. And I do think that the game industry, if I had to pick one thing, you know, it's the fact that the arena.net guys, their source code control system and their publishing system are the same thing, right? There's like when they check in a piece of code, it's really just a setting as to whether or not it's going to a private internal build or going all the way out to customers. And that, you know, is just a mind-boggling advantage we have, and as a result of that sort of aggressive way that the gaming community has adopted the internet and the tools and opportunities of the internet, compared to, you know, I can bitch as much as I want at my DVD player and it's not going to fix anything about the movie or the TV series that I'm watching.
Is there an over communication though? We see, you just remarked about how Steven Spielberg was making War Horse and he couldn't hear from his fans about the quality of the work that he was producing. Do we live in a time where we have an over-communication with our developers, specifically talking about the Mass Effect 3 controversy that happened a few weeks ago?
Well, you guys are content producers. Do you say to yourself, you know, holy shit, we hear too much from our fans. I wish they would shut up and we would do a much better job if they weren't...
Well, this is our first podcast. We have no fans yet. So, I mean, that's...
Okay. Well, I think you're going to find that every time you can get feedback, make a decision, you know, execute against that decision, and then see how it affects things, you're going to say that, oh my God, it's so much easier to make our stuff better once we're in that loop with our customers. On the other hand, you know, back when I was at Microsoft, you would make a decision about an operating system and it would be 5 years before anybody would be affected by that decision you made, right? I mean, you could be at an entirely different company or on a different project before there was any signal back, you know, so you had this huge temporal delay and you could always blame it on somebody else, like, oh, it was a great decision, but the guys overworking on the kernel totally screwed it up.
I understand. Shifting gears a little bit, on Friday, CNET reported that Apple's Tim Cook was spotted at Valve headquarters, which obviously sent the rumor mill into overdrive. Can you comment on the meeting, and does this signal a new foray into handheld gaming?
Sure. We all sent mail to each other going, who's Tim Cook meeting with? Right? It was like, is he meeting with you? I'm not meeting with Tim Cook. So it's one of those rumors that was stated so factually that we actually were like confused. Nobody here was meeting with Tim Cook or with anybody at Apple that day. So I wish we were. I mean, we have a long list of things we'd love to see Apple do to support games and gaming better. But no, we didn't meet with Tim Cook. Seems like a good, smart guy, but I've never actually met him.
Speaking of Apple, do you think that Apple shares the values that Valve has as a corporation?
No. I'm not sure what you're asking specifically. We're very different companies. We think that our business interests are served best long-term by operating in a way that's consistent with open collaborative approaches with both our customers and our partners. Apple is sort of, you know, I'd say Nintendo and Apple are a lot closer together than Valve and Apple are. You know, they both have such a strong, clear design ethic. And then if you want to go along for the ride, you can. But it would be hard to see something like the Steam Workshop coming out in the context of something that Apple does. I have lots of Apple products. You know, I've got my iPad 3 sitting next to me here while we're doing this interview. But the two companies are very different.
So do you think that Steam has a future in working with Apple, moving towards some sort of collaborative effort in the future?
We may, but we haven't really talked to them very much about that.
Just switching over to some numbers, as a total worldwide sales of consoles, Wii has sold 94 million, Xbox 65, PS3 is 62. On that same topic of Apple, the iPad has actually sold 55 million. I know you're a big iPad user. Would you consider it the fourth console?
You know, I'm not sure. It is what it is, right? It's the iPad. And, you know, with all of the... You know, if you tried to take what somebody had learned on the Wii and tried to apply that to trying to be successful on the iPad, I think that would be bad. I think you'd fail. So thinking of it as a console rather than thinking of it as its own thing. You know, Tim, I've talked to Tim Sweeney and Mike Capps and the guys at Epic a lot. And, you know, they're investing a lot in understanding, you know, what to do to be successful in the tablet space and in the phone space. And when we talk with them, they don't talk about it in terms of it's like working on a console. I mean, technically, in terms of the product that you design, in terms of the relationship with Apple, it's pretty different than working on the consoles. Is it a interesting business opportunity? I think that it's a lot easier for today's game companies to make money on the consoles. You know, Apple's really good at driving, you know, partner margin to zero. And is, you know, they have lots and lots and lots of content, you know, but, you know, they've yet to make any of their partners rich. And the consoles definitely have been valuable to, you know, guys like Activision, and certainly Epic's been doing great, and so on. And Apple doesn't really have those kinds of partner stories yet.
Going back to an earlier question, talking about the movement within the industry over the last couple of years and what positive trends there have been, you just pointed out a couple, but what negative trends do you see, and what would you like to personally see to stop?
Well, I tend to be kind of a pro-consumer guy, so any of my answers you can sort of predict. Anything that's, you know, harmful or perceived as negative by customers. So, you know, the nice thing is those things tend to get smashed pretty quickly. We do seem to be entering into a sort of a little bit of a tech and mobile and social bubble environment. And the issue with that is it creates a sort of reality distortion field, to steal a description about Steve Jobs, you know, which, you know, people stop thinking about the person who plays the game as being the customer and start thinking about the IPO as being the customer. And when people, you know, when millions of dollars are being tossed around in the neighborhood, you see a lot of people optimizing for things that are pretty short term and not long term. So, you know, we've been through this many, many times. I mean, the first time I saw something like this was, you know, Eagle Computer, just to really date myself, back in the, when it was like 1984. But you can just see a bunch of decisions that stopped being about how can I have a customer who's going to be with me 10 years from now, as opposed to, you know, how can I make my giant pile of money as quickly as possible and then get out of this, you know, get out of my stock position as fast as I can. And, you know, as long as the games industry continues to grow, we're going to also have those kinds of distortions. But right now it seems to be stronger than it was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. I think that you just end up wasting a bunch of people's time and money, and then that blows up and blows over, and people start focusing on the fundamentals more.
Now, moving ahead to the next 5 years, what advances in the game industry do you think that Valve can be leading on?
Well, I think we're trying to think hard about how to create value across a collection of games, and it'll be interesting to see how valuable that is to people. We're also looking hard at both the living room space and the mobile space to try to see if we can't create open hardware platforms that we, you know, the industry can use, so we can get out of the sort of proprietary traps that we're headed in both of those. That involves some fairly out there hardware design. So, you know, we have no reason to believe we can be any good at that. So hopefully we have something to add there, but we'll, you know, time will tell. I hope, you know, that just how we think about the relationships with our customers and our partners over time will influence people. You know, for some reason, the story about Eric Wolpaw when he was sick and we sent him home to get better, for some reason that story came back with a lot of traction recently. And you know, talking to other people at other companies, it still seemed like a super novel, radical kind of thing to do. And I would have thought that as an industry, we would have been a little further along this idea of how important those kinds of both professional relationships and customer relationships are. So hopefully by continuing to be successful and advocating for that sort of philosophy, we can impact people as well. But, you know, we're going to keep doing it regardless. So, and it certainly worked super well for us. So even if other people don't view that as a smart way to run their businesses, we're going to continue to do it. It just seems weird that you continue to have these punitive, highly asymmetric ways of thinking about both the people that you work with and the customers that you're building for.
Well, that actually leads me into my next question. LA Noire and Team Bande specifically got a lot of criticism for the particularly tough working conditions with no overtime pay and excessive hours. It seems like this incident doesn't exist in a vacuum, although Valve has been always received incredibly high marks on the treatment of employees, specifically that case that you referenced. Do you think that there's a need in the industry for a union amongst development staff?
Well, I mean, if it helped, that would be fine. I tend to be skeptical. Just having studied a little bit of the histories of unions, what you end up actually happening is you create some third party whose interest is actually a lot of times who have perverse incentives to actually make relationships fail and end up justifying themselves as an important intermediary. I mean, the thing we do is we hire anybody who can make it through the interview process, we hire. And there are, you know, like fingers on one hand of people who've left the company, you know, in the last, you know, since we started the company in 1996. So we just think that it's just a fundamentally bad business decision to treat the people that you are working for or working with poorly. And every year, you know, we are more profitable, right? It's not like treating everybody around you like shit means that you're more profitable. It makes you less profitable, and it doesn't take long before those sins come home to roost. You know, there'll always be people who do dumb things. All I can really say to people who are working in the industry or customers is, you know, go find the people who treat you with respect. And buy their products and work with those people. And over the long run, we'll eliminate those kinds of practices from our industry. And the ridiculous thing is, we're like one of the most profitable, you know, we just see this as the right way to run your business. If you're just being a cold-hearted bastard, it still makes sense to do things the way we do them. And, you know, I'll keep telling people that. For some reason, it seems hard for people to get their mind wrapped around that idea. But if your whole goal is to make as much money as possible, treat your customers well, right? Treat the people you work with really well, and you'll make more money. So I don't know how to be more blunt about it to people who don't get it.
One of our members was asking to follow up on regarding the Metacritic score for New Vegas and how those developers lost a lot of money based on that score. Valve Games have always placed very high on Metacritic. Do you think that Metacritic has had a perverse reaction to the industry? And if so, can you see anything, a change in interaction between the critics and the user and the developers to kind of make that space better?
We don't know how to game Metacritic. I mean, we haven't ever sat down and said, ooh, how can we make our Metacritic score better? I'm not really sure how you would do that. I mean, but I do think that there's a lot of, I mean, as a, let's flip it around. As a moviegoer, I find that Metacritic score is really, really full to me in making decisions. mean that I won't go to the a low Metacritic movie score movie? No. And have on the other hand, if I look at the Metacritic score for something like The Separation, will it tip me over to go and see that movie? Absolutely. So in general, I think that Metacritic is surprisingly effective, at least for me, in evaluating the quality. Do I think tying specific Metacritic scores to employee compensation is a good idea? No. There are lots of, there are much better ways of designing compensation systems than that. I mean, what you, I mean, if I were working at a company that had that, I would, you know, I would pull whatever strings I could to get onto the teams that were, you know, I would go to the team that didn't need me because they were already going to get a good Metacritic score. And that doesn't necessarily seem to be the smartest way to design your internal incentives. You know, I think that giving people performance feedback is much harder than just telling them what their Metacritic score was. You know, there's more subtleties and thoughtfulness that has to go into it. And the same is true in how you do whatever compensation scheme you have. So I don't know the specific story that you're referring to. I think I can kind of guess. But no, I think that, you know, I've never really... I would say that their overall accuracy of Metacritic is pretty good. It's sort of, you know, there are lots of other ways where you can aggregate information, and Steam actually gives us a whole bunch of different ways of doing that as well. But they tend to correlate fairly well with Metacritic scores. That makes sense?
Absolutely. If I'm not correct, I'm actually bringing up my Steam account right now. Doesn't Steam also list Metacritic scores in Steam?
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I think we just started to have a really long list of games on Steam, and somebody said, hey, we should have some way so that people, you know, we need to provide more information. So knowing which games your friends have, that's really useful information. Knowing what the Metacritic scores, that's really useful information. Having links to forums is useful information. In general, we try to think about it, like, what is the most useful thing for people to know in making decisions about where they're going to spend their time and their money? Metacritic. We all use Metacritic scores in our heads, so it seemed like a useful thing. So we called up the guys there and said, hey, you know, can we figure out how we can automatically incorporate Metacritic into our game views? And they said, yeah, here's an API. So it was, they're actually super easy to work with. The fundamental underlying principle is, for each person, what is the most useful information you can give them in making decisions about how they allocate their time and their money? And more and more, it's going to look, the most valuable things are going to be things about what your friends are doing or what you're trying to achieve in the long run. Metacritic scores were a useful step along the way. The goal is, you know, essentially helping people make good decisions about how they spend their time.
A bit of personal indulgence before we wrap it up. Have you been playing Hero Academy?
No. Should I?
You should really be playing Hero Academy. Okay. It's pretty fantastic.
Anything else I should be playing?
Hero Academy. A lot of our guys would probably be able to fill you in. Also, Saints Row the Third, pretty fantastic.
Okay.
DLC, not so much. Did you actually play Saints Row the Third? I'm curious.
No, I haven't. I have to be honest. I'm sort of stuck on Dota 2, so. And I know I should play something else, but I've been bit pretty hard by that. So I'll go play Hero Academy and Saints Row 3.
How much time did you spend, if any, with League of Legends? I know you kind of feel out other games and other game spaces. Did you spend any time with League of Legends? Have you played it?
No, I haven't played.
And what are your thoughts?
I haven't played League of Legends, Yeah, so I have no impressions of it.
Last question that I have here is one of the future of handheld gaming. We talked a lot up today about how you can create value for your customers. Do you see Valve entering into that space? And what do you think it would take for Valve to be entering into that space? What kind of game would you envision Valve bringing to a platform like that?
Well, we're trying to think about where we would actually do something that was interestingly valuable. And also, one of the nice things about that space is it's converging in many ways very rapidly with the console and PC gaming spaces. If you look at, you know, Infinity Blade 2, it's like, wow, you know, that's pretty impressive. There are aspects of it. One of the annoying things is that laptops aren't as reliably connected to the internet as certainly the iOS devices are. So you're actually seeing people developing more connectivity-oriented features in some of their iOS games. Also, you know, location and cameras seem to be completely unexploited features. One thing that several people are thinking a lot about is, so this is an example where people here think augmented reality has a huge opportunity, and I'm kind of a Luddite on that. If we end up shipping an augmented reality game, you can know that I was wrong and Abrash was right. Because I look at that, I still haven't got my head wrapped around how that gets better. And Abrash is absolutely confident that at some point something really cool will emerge. And that would be the scenario where we would ship something where we thought we were actually adding some unique value. And we believe that there are those opportunities. We just haven't figured out what they are. Part of the reason to be dinking around with hardware prototypes is to try to redefine the opportunity space and see what sort of cool things are possible. So I think that one of the things we would hope is that we would see an opportunity that involved thinking more up and down the entire, you know, hardware to game experience stack and come up with some innovation there. That's certainly what we're hoping to be able to do. Do we know what that is yet? No. But we're going to be trying to figure that out.
And on that note, I have only one last question, and it's a softball. Mayo or Miracle Whip?
I grew up totally white trash in the military, so I used to eat Miracle Whip and Velveeta cheese sandwiches, so I'm a Miracle Whip guy, as sad as I am to say that.
Now, Miracle Whip is awesome. There is nothing.
I'm filled with
sandwich.
I'm filled with Miracle Whip shame. So.
A sandwich just isn't a sandwich without the tangy zip of Miracle Whip.
Nice.
And they are not a sponsor, but I want to reach out right now to Kraft and say if you would like to sponsor our second episode, we'd be glad to have you. Gabe, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. I know from myself, Mitch, and the entire DCD crew, we really loved having you.
Thank you, and good luck with the podcast, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. After this break, we'll have a post-interview roundtable with the entire DCD crew. And we're back. I'm joined with the director of programming, Dylan. How you doing, Dylan?
Hey, man. We just had an epic interview, did we not?
I think it was pretty unbelievably epic. The man responsible for that interview, Mitch Fryman. How you doing, Mitch?
I'm doing pretty well. How you doing, Jack?
Excellent. I'm quaking with anticipation. No, that's I don't even think that's a thing. Rounding out the group are my two best buds, Joy R, a contributor to the site. How you doing, Joy?
I can't complain, especially after that interview.
And finally, we have Miguel. Miguel is the director of communication and Mitch's boss. So what do you think of the job that Mitch did, Miguel?
You know, every now and then, a man has to consider a fellatio as a way of payment to someone, so...
That's one way of saying it was a good job.
Are you offering that to me, Miguel?
I don't know, man. That was amazing. Like, seriously, I cannot thank you enough. That was an amazing interview, and you did a great job getting us that, man. High five through the internet.
Very well done indeed.
I think they... If a lot of people probably don't know the origin of this, how this all kind of came together, Mitch ended up just emailing Gabe out of nowhere and said, "Hey, Gabe, what you doing next week?" And he's like, "Nothing, bear stuff." And he just wrote back and said, "Yeah, let's go do this thing. Let's get wild."
Right. Then, I'd like to be the first to say that I cannot wait for a Valve augmented reality kit.
I think that would be great with our Google Glass, which kind of leads us into the first thing they were talking about. Dylan, what are you thinking about augmented reality, man?
I don't know. He's just talking about how he could make something like unique and satisfying, and basically just said, if we can create something that we think is really cool, then we're going to ship it. So, we're thinking
about it. When he was saying that, I already pictured like an augmented reality fight the ant lions while you're on your way to the bank, walking down the city, like, you know, just like, "I'm bored, I want to fight some ant lions," or popping out of the ground, you know.
I would play that.
What's an ant lion before we go any further?
Hearsay. Kick him out of here.
You know, the really huge and annoying things from Half-Life 2, the ones that come out of the ground going, and then jump you?
Wait, those were called ant lions?
Yeah.
I just figured they were called scary-ass, big-ass bugs that jump out of the ground and eat your ass.
I think ant lions are in Final Fantasy as well, aren't they?
I don't know. I don't play women games.
So, wait a minute. Are we saying that any giant ant is an ant lion?
Absolutely. I'm sure there's like a magic card.
But, how about a tiny, tiny ant with a lion's mane? Is that still an ant lion?
That's a lion ant.
Fair
enough.
And then he talks about location and what if you did location and augmented reality? Like, they already have the location zombie game, but like, what if with the location zombie games, you could see them in your augmented reality and they're chasing you and you and your friends are...
That's a really good way to trip over your augmented legs and bust your $500 augmented glasses.
I've never heard of these location zombie games. Did he mention it in the interview, or is this something else?
No, this is just already... That's already out, man. It's like on Android. There's all sorts of little location features, but like he said, nobody's used them really like in a serious game.
Okay, so let me
dude, you can play Battlefield 3 in like your living room, or better yet, like a park by you.
Awesome.
Like, what if it was that?
For a moment. You get out of your house. You have to an appointment on the other side of the city, so you get into your, you know, autopilot Google car, and you tell it, "Hey, man, we're going to the bank, or we're going to whatever in the other side of the city." You put on your Google Glass, you load up Steam on it, and then you're flying a TIE fighter, burning people down or whatever. That'll be great.
I think that will be great and incredibly illegal. There's no way that people are going to allow...
Reality and driving.
Exactly. There's going to be an impairment clause in all of this where it's like, you can't use your augmented glasses while driving.
But augmented glasses could actually help driving. They could perhaps perceive what's going on around you and point out stuff that you wouldn't notice yourself, like a biker, you know, in your peripheral or something like that. I mean, maybe not for gaming, but they could have potential to help you while driving.
I think hold on, before we get off this topic, I think that there is room there for growth, because you have heads-up displays on basically every fighter jet out there. You know, there could be a real application here. I just don't see it coming to games anytime soon.
I would like the idea that Mitch has, except for the fact that I already wear glasses. And have you ever tried to wear glasses on top of glasses? It's kind of a pain in the ass.
No,
I heard you like glasses. Last thought on this, the Woe Dude comment. What happens when the whole world is just augmented reality? Because we destroyed everything.
The holodeck?
Yeah. Okay.
Life gets boring.
Dota 2.
What about it?
Valve is terrible at Dota. They go to a tournament. They fail. So they're like, well, we'll make our own game. And they're like, well, we are Valve, so let's get Ice Frog, and now it's Dota 2.
Absolutely. That was a ridiculously amazing story, you know, and hearing an origin of a game like that, that's something that can inspire people, you know, pretty hardcore. Just someone's like, I want to do this. Who's on board? And then it grows into what Dota 2 is now and will be in the future.
Just like our podcast.
Just like our podcast.
Exactly.
I'm sure our podcast will have the same success as Dota 2.
Yes.
And if wishes are horses.
The Koreans will love us.
Yes.
I like that as a phrase. If wishes are horses, the Koreans will love us.
I think that's the tagline of the show right there.
Yeah, right there. That's it.
Yeah.
I have to say I'm very, very glad about the free-to-play thing, even though it might come with a couple extra things. But we're going to have to look into that because, let's be honest, that was pretty much the only way that they were going to be able to take some of the people who know nothing about MOBAs from League of Legends.
Call me old school, but I'd pay $40. I'd pay $60 for Dota 2 if I didn't pay anything else for it.
But that's the wonderful thing, is I think that they're probably going to have variable pricing options. There's probably going to be a free-to-play model where you can, you know, slowly but surely, you know, rank up all these guys. Probably have a $20, you know, half collector's pack with half the guys already in it, and then probably a $40 model where everything is in there unlocked from day one.
I actually really like that idea. I never thought about that. Maybe that's the twist he was talking about in the interview.
Well, that's kind of the same idea that I was thinking they might do, you know, having like rotating heroes like most other MOBA games do, and then if you felt like paying the full price, you could have all the heroes, or perhaps buy single heroes or hero packs or something like that. But myself, I would easily buy the $50 game if it's available.
I have to say, after that interview, I was a huge fan of Gabe going into it. I'm a huge fan of Gabe coming out of it. But after playing some Dota this week, I will be hard pressed to wonder whether or not they're going to be able to adequately teach me how to play Dota. And is that the game's responsibility? Kind of gets into a larger question of whether or not, you know, games really are there to teach you how to play the game.
You make a good point, and, you know, I think that they will introduce a tutorial of some sort. I mean, if you look at TF2, it took them how long to put a tutorial in it, but it's there now.
But is TF2 inherently a different thing than a MOBA? You know, is a first-person shooter... Look, we've all been playing first-person shooters since when did Doom come out? You know, early 90s? So all of that, you know, having the WSAD keys set up for you and kind of having a language
it.
There.
TF2 is not as simple as, you know, run and gun. It's got so many classes and so many items now that, you know, it takes you a while to get acquainted with all the different stuff you can actually do.
Yeah, but if you go back to the very first iteration of TF2, it was a run and gun. There was a couple different, you know, variations on it, but there it was, you know, your demo had sticky bombs and, you know, that's pretty much it. There wasn't, you know, 1,000 different weapons out there. There wasn't the Islander. There weren't these other things. So you had a very simple game at its core, which expanded out to be a much more complex game. That simple game at its core was still a first-person shooter.
Well, I mean, with Dota, though, there is going to eventually, right now, you know, being in beta, the community is not amazingly large. And when we group up, it makes it harder for it to find opponents that are equal to all of our levels. So, for instance, since I've played 300 plus games, it might be finding people more to my level than, you know, to you who's played, what, somewhere around 10 games?
If that.
I think unlocking characters in Dota is way different than unlocking guns in any first-person shooter. And I think that that's bad for the learning curve. I think companies need to realize that. I feel like every hero should be available so people can learn.
Well, every hero is currently available, and we don't know for a fact that they're going to do the rotation model like Heroes of New Earth and stuff, which, to be honest, I hope that that's not the route they go with, but, I mean, it's a possibility, and it's a likely, you know, outcome.
Yeah, but Dylan, how are you going to monetize it if all of the heroes are available day one?
Hats. Custom skins. Or, I mean, what did Gabe talk to us about? That might have been, you know, post-interview, just talking to him, but he talked about having something that you could make in Skyrim as your horse and bring it over to the Dota world and have it be your courier. Something like that, and then people could maybe pay for that skin, and it'll both go to Valve and the creator of the skin, maybe.
Yeah, I think they're really going to expand on the Steam Workshop and the Steam community.
But I think the name of the game here has to be Barrier of Entry. Let's see how we actually get people into the game, because if a random newbie just says, hey, new free-to-play game here on Steam, just download it, get it going, and try it out, and it's someone who has zero experience with MOBAs, if he runs into the average community that these sort of games get, he's not going to play more than two games.
Well, that's why those lobbies, they need to be sectioned off. You know, there is a comparison
Newbie
to be
Island.
Made. Yeah, exactly, Newbie Island. There is a comparison to be made about how, you know, MMOs and Blizzard and, you know, introduced their clients to a very rich world and a very freaking complex world at the end of the day.
I think of the system that StarCraft 2 uses, where they have placement matches, where you are put into simpler versions of the maps with some things tuned down a little, and you say you have the opportunity to do 50 of them against very, very new people before you're actually inside the gaming pool, and you can step out of them at any point, really, really would help a game like this.
I like it. It's a good idea.
I'm not a fan of StarCraft 2 myself, but I do have to admit I like their ability to match you with people of your skill level with their pre-game...
The ranking, yeah.
Yeah, that.
Joy, you played World of Warcraft for a lot of years. What if they had, like, matchmaking for groups in order of skill? You would get put into Ice Crown Citadel with people of your skill level based on, stats in the game.
If it would play out like how I'm envisioning it, based on that really short description, I would love it. That would be a pretty good thing. I mean, because at least as far as MMOs go, some people just have a pain in the ass time finding a group or finding a guild, or maybe they only want to go just once or twice for the experience, but they don't want to have to commit to a guild that's running it, you know, 3 days a week or whatever.
I don't want to bust in here and ruin anybody's day, but this actually already exists and is Raid Finder and is already in WoW.
And I love it.
Yeah, but I think they could make that a little bit more like matchmaking and scale the difficulty with the matchmaking. But you might get stuck just like in League of Legends, but Dota's more like it. You might get stuck in a lower matchmaking and never be able to escape, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that makes sense.
We've been talking about what we can do and we cannot do in Dota and what could happen and how great it could actually be, but how about how great Valve is as a company?
I mean, to be like Gabe and to be in charge of a company like that, I mean, that man's moral compass is ridiculous for a businessman. I mean, he cares so much about the community that you would think it would be bad for the company, but obviously not. I mean, Valve does very well.
Yeah, he seems to really, really be looking after what is best for the consumers and really believes that as long as you're making a good game, people will come to him. If you build a great game, nerds will come.
No pun intended, I hope.
Oh, God, that's awful. Thanks. I'm glad we're really keeping it above the fray on that one.
But hey, I have to say, we're nerds, so we wouldn't actually come in pairs.
Oh, God.
Good night, everybody.
Oh, man.
I like how you derailed a bit.
Yeah, it's a family show. The you know, I think he made some really great points throughout the interview, and one of them was fundamentally that, you know, if it's bad to treat people poorly, and if you're more profitable, you're going to become successful and rich.
Shouldn't that be common sense though? I mean, you know, looking at say EA, shouldn't they realize, hey, everyone's getting pissed off about what we're doing, maybe we should try and change it?
Yeah, exactly.
It would work if the average consumer in our market wasn't sadly very much a pushover. Like, we're flocking to Valve, and eventually it does seem like the trend is changing, but as it stands right now, no matter what EA puts in their game, how bad the ending of Mass Effect 3 was, how terrible the writing in Dragon Age 2 or the combat was, people will still go for it.
It's like,
because they want to play the game. They want to go through the experience. Yeah. And if they say, how much bad can I do if I buy the game?
It's like when you see people, you know, saying I'm going to boycott this game or I'm going to boycott that game. Like with Battlefield 3, you saw a bunch of people say they were going to boycott it. And I thought about it myself, but I was such a fan of Battlefield 3 that I couldn't. I love Battlefield 3. So, I mean, the Battlefield series is amazing. Battlefield 3 could be better. It's not Battlefield 2, in my opinion, but I do enjoy it.
I still haven't bought it at all. I refuse. I absolutely refuse. I'm not going to go out. I'm one of the few people that were like at the beginning of Battlefield and people being like, oh man, I gotta buy this thing. And then, you know, Reddit was all in up in arms. And we all grabbed our pitchforks and walked outside. And a bunch of people went, no, it's fucking cold outside. I'm not going out there. I'm going to buy this motherfucker. At which point I went, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to stick by my guns. And you can go and search and find that I do not have an Origin account, and I definitely don't own Battlefield 3, because I'm not going to give in to a shitty service just to play these.
It's a great game, though, but it is a great game. But Origin itself is shitty, and I hope that Battlefield 3 comes to Steam, because I'll play it a lot more than I play it right now.
But you already gave them your $50, so...
That's very true. I mean, you know, they... As far as they're probably concerned, they're not going to see much more in the Battlefield 3 sales, which is what I think they did with the recent patch they had, where people can just pay to get every gun in the game, which really pisses me off, by the way, but I digress.
I think there's way too much cheese in Battlefield 3. And speaking of cheese, turns out that Gabe really likes Velveeta and Miracle Whip sandwiches.
We learned so much about the man.
Did you guys like that transition?
I did like that. And you know what? I used to eat Miracle Whip sandwiches as a kid. Just Miracle Whip, put it on some bread and eat it. Oh no, it's delicious.
That's fucking gross.
It's very sweet.
That's too much.
It's very sweet, but it's delicious.
Just Miracle Whip and white bread?
I think I normally ate wheat.
America, you're America. I was about to say, you are the whitest person I have ever heard. final notes before we wrap this thing up.
I'd actually like to say one more thing about food real fast. If you guys have never tried it, peanut butter on a hamburger. Delicious.
I've heard good things about that. I'll have to try it next time I get a burger.
I've heard avocado on hamburgers, and I'm just not a fan of that consistency. Ugh, no, it's just too squishy. Not for me.
Okay, so at least my final notes. Gabe's a really, really nice guy, and I cannot believe he would go this far for the fans as giving us, well, we took a bit of time from a billionaire, so that's amazing. Also, the way that he's running his company, the way he keeps... a straight team, and he doesn't swap people around unless it's really necessary. And the way how ethically Valve seems to run around everything, and how much help they seem to be towards your average company and even your indie devs, I think they have a bright future ahead. And honestly, I have nothing against Origin. It's not that great of a service. Personally, I can't say I won't use it because it's not Steam and it's not comfortable or whatever. I'm all for competition, but they really need to step it up.
Absolutely. Yeah, so,
exactly.
Dylan, you guys want to
say I just want to say thank you to Mitch, of course, for setting up this interview, guys. Miguel, thank you for joining us, our community director. Joy. Yes, sir. Joy, a site contributor. Make sure you check out his articles as well as some others that we've thrown up. And Jack.
I also want to say thanks to Chris, the IT over at Valve, for helping us set up the interview and making everything work on their end.
Yeah, absolutely. Big shout out to Chris, the PR guy over there that helped us out. He did a really amazing job.
Still waiting on your friend request on Steam, buddy.
Well, meanwhile, as you guys were all getting thanked, Mitch actually interrupted Dylan as he was about to thank me, and instead there was just quiet.
Yeah, I guess, you know, we could thank Jack as well.
I guess.
I guess.
Whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You have a beard.
Hey, brought us all together, so why not?
I get no love.
All right, 1, 2, 3. Thank you, Jack.
Yeah, fuck off.
Okay, just me.
Hey, thanks to the Redditor community, too, for listening.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
That's going to wrap it up for this week of the 7-Day Cooldown. Big thanks to everyone that's listening, everyone that's helped out, all of our site contributors, everybody who's done an amazing job this week. We will be back, hopefully, when about a week after this is edited and up on the site. We don't have a day that we're going out every week. So it's kind of going to be a little bit touch and go. But we're hoping that you stay with us. And I'm really excited. So everybody say goodnight.
See ya.
Good night.
Good night. See you guys.
Thank you for listening, everybody.